This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Hasan Minhaj, is a correspondent on The Daily Show. He was hired by Jon Stewart just a few months before Stewart left the show. The Trump administration has provided plenty of material for satire, but it's also created serious concerns for the Minhaj family. His parents are Muslim immigrants from India. On his post-election night piece on The Daily Show, he ended by talking about how his mother, an American citizen, was visiting family in India, and they were worried that a Muslim ban would be instituted that would make it difficult for her to get back home to America. Just a few weeks ago, Minhaj was the MC at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and did stand-up, roasting the president and the press. Usually, the president does stand-up, too, but this year, President Trump declined to attend the dinner. Here's Minhaj at the dinner.
I would say it is an honor to be here, but that would be an alternative fact. It is not. No one wanted to do this. So of course it lands in the hands of an immigrant. It's how it always goes down. No one wanted this gig. No one.
Now Hasan Minhaj has a Netflix comedy special called Homecoming King. It's about growing up in Davis, California, the son of immigrants. Let's start with a clip in which he's telling the story of the anonymous threatening phone call his father received at home right after 9/11. Just after the phone call, the windows on the family car were shattered. Hasan Minhaj went out into the street to see if he could find who did it.
I look back in the middle of the street. My dad's in the middle of the road, sweeping glass out of the road like he works at like a hate crime barbershop. Just like, we got customers, Lokya gang, we gotta clean this up. Zen, brown Mr. Miyagi, just like not saying a word. I run up to him like, Dad, why aren't you saying something? I'm not asking you now, say something. He looks at me and he goes, Hasan, ye cheeze to hote? Or ye cheeze hoenge? These things happen, and these things will continue to happen. That's the price we pay for being here. And that's when I was like, oh no, we really are from two different generations. Like, BMX bikes aside. Like, my dad's from that generation, like a lot of immigrants, where he feels like if you come to this country, you pay this thing like the American dream tax, right? Like, you're gonna endure some racism, and if it doesn't cost you your life, well, hey, you lucked out, pay it. There you go, Uncle Sam. But for me, like a lot of us, I was born here. So I actually have the audacity of equality.
That's an excerpt of Homecoming King. Hasan Minhaj, welcome to Fresh Air. I love this new show.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
Can you talk a little bit more about the difference in your point of view about what it means to be an immigrant and a Muslim in America now, and what the difference generationally between your father as an immigrant and you as somebody who was born here?
Yeah, the biggest difference between, and I feel like a lot of third culture kids feel this, and I identify as a third culture kid, meaning that, you know, my family's from Aligarh, India. They immigrated to America. I was born here. I exist in this hyphen. I'm an Indian American Muslim kid, but am I more Indian? Am I more American? What part of my identity am I? And one of the biggest things immigrant kids oftentimes feel is it's this big disparity between our parents and us. Our parents are staunch pragmatists, and we actually, I consider myself to be an optimist, you know? So when my dad immigrated here, we talk about it in the show, there's this thing called, you know, the American dream tax. You're going to come here, you're going to endure some struggles, some problems. But if you don't die, if it doesn't cost you your life, well, hey, you lucked out. My dad is a child of partition when it happened in India. So if I explain the concept of microaggressions to him, he's like, I dealt with full-on aggression. You're lucky. Put your head down and go.
Right, partition is when Pakistan divided from India, and there was a lot on both sides of this new border. There was a lot of violence and a lot of death.
Yes, and it was one of the largest mass exoduses of people from India to Pakistan. My dad's family stayed in Aligarh in India, which was a huge decision because you're dividing a country based on religious lines. So the things that he saw and witnessed as a kid, he doesn't want to hear about my identity crises at school, you know, and how I want to just, you know, fall in love and fit in. For him, things that he witnessed during that generation and era were very, very extreme and oftentimes violent. But what's weird is, you know, for me as a kid growing up, going to school, taking honors gov in high school and learning about equality and civil liberties, you actually at a young age have this sense of optimism where you're like, oh, so I am equal. that means I shouldn't be treated this way. And, you know, that night, you know, when I tell that story of September 12th, it was the first night of so many nights where I kind of was put in this position where, do I think like my dad? You know, do I sweep up the glass that's in the road? Do I sort of just forget this hate crime? Do I sweep up the glass that way the neighbors don't see it and just go back inside and actually be grateful that they broke the windows on the car, they didn't break the windows to the house, and try to, you know, come in and do something and just, hey, just count my blessings? Or do I use this as a moment to be like, no, this is wrong, and I should speak up and say something, because it's these moments where maybe my generation can move the needle forward a little bit and talk about this. But that pendulum swings back and forth for me all the time. I don't have a clear, this is the way you deal with this. There's sometimes where maybe my dad's right, and there's sometimes where I'm like, no, I think he's wrong. I think being an angry optimist is the solution.
So there are a lot of cultural differences between you and your father. And let's start with the fact that your father hadn't even met your mother when he decided to marry her. Can you describe the circumstances of their marriage?
My dad was doing grad school, and he was in Aligarh. You know, he was of age to get married. And he had heard about this girl named Seema, my mom. And the hype around Seema, she was like the iPhone 8 of Aligarh. People were just like, oh my God, have you heard of this girl named Seema? She's very slim and slender, and her family owns a camera. And my dad was like, oh my God, a camera, I can't believe this. You know, so he just, off of just this Yelp review of who she was and what her family was like, he just ran down to my grandfather's house and laid it all on the line. He's just like, what's up? I'm Najmi. I'm a chemist. I'm going to America. Please let me marry Seema. And in 10 minutes, he married a woman he had never laid eyes on. And it's a pretty incredible story when I think about it, because that level of decisiveness is something that I don't have. I'm his son. I don't have that level of decisiveness. But because of that decision, I'm here.
Okay, so he marries your mother without meeting her. You, on the other hand, you were born in 1985. So you grew up with, like, hip-hop. You know, you grew up with television and movies, but the kind of television and movies where sex is a constant presence. And
sex before
marriage is a constant presence.
Yeah.
And so, again, like, the difference between, like, your father's cultural values growing up in India and your own growing up here are so much at odds with each other. And obviously, like, you wanted to fit in when you were in high school. Was it hard for you to find a place where you could survive at home and be your father's son, but also be the person you wanted to be at school and with your friends?
Yeah. His rules with me growing up were very simple. No fun, no friends, no girlfriends. You can have fun in med school, which is just like a huge lie. That's just a blatant lie. It never, you know, you go to a club and you just see a bunch of dudes going crazy. Like, what's going on, fellas? Oh, what's going on? Residency. Like, I'm having the time of my life. It doesn't work like that. But I felt like, for my dad, I am his first round draft pick. You know, like, I'm the LeBron James to his franchise. I have to deliver the dream. And I am aware of that. I go back to Aligarh and I go back to Delhi often, where my cousins live now. And I'm very aware of the opportunity that I have when I go meet them. And that's where I understand and I empathize with what my dad feels. And when I was in high school and trying to meet and talk to girls, go to the movies on a weekend, try to maybe go to, like, some sort of social event, I never would invite school friends over to my house. I would go over to, you know, like, my friends' houses. It was just about trying to fit in and find my place in the world, where my dad really felt, look, if you take care of these necessary things, you'll find your place. But I meant that emotionally. I want to find my place emotionally. Where do I belong, you know? And that was a tough thing for him to understand.
So was comedy like a secret weapon for you in school, like a way for you to be yourself and stand out? And what did your father think of comedy?
In high school, I didn't know what comedy was, but I was involved in speech and debate and public speaking.
Close. And impromptu speaking. Close.
Yeah. But
debate club, stand up. Yeah.
But no, actually, believe it or not,
they are close.
They are very similar. When I got to college, that's when I was first exposed to stand-up comedy. I didn't know what it was. My parents didn't let us have cable television. So I thought stand-up comedy was the stuff that Seinfeld did before Seinfeld, where he's just like, hey, you ever notice, like, what's with the deal with laundry? And I was always like, I hate that part of Seinfeld. Like, get to the episode. Then when I get to college, I get exposed to Pryor, Bring the Pain, Chris, all this like really edgy, subversive stuff, all this stuff that I could never say in my house or at school. They're being critical of the government. I mean, they're really being provocative. Carlin, these guys are really pushing the edge. And that's when I realized, oh, that's funny speech and debate. Like, my favorite comedians are just presenting an argument and they're doing it in a funny way. And whenever I would do speech and debate, forensics, or like there was a division called impromptu speaking, you're given a topic. If you can make the judges laugh, or if you could ridicule your opponent's position and make the judges laugh, I always would do better on the scorecard. So when I had this sort of, oh my God, like, that's it. I've been doing that. Like, I know how to do that. And that's when I really wanted to get into comedy and sort of like political comedy and talk about a lot of these topics that sometimes would be too taboo to talk about in other settings.
Let's talk about your mother. We talked about how your father decided to marry your mother through kind of hearing about her through word of mouth and seeing a picture. They got married, they moved to the States, but she went right back to India soon after because she was studying medicine and wanted to complete med school there. So basically for the first 8 years of your life, you were brought up by your father with occasional visits from your mother.
Yes. Yes.
So how much did you know about her for the first 8 years of your life?
I definitely knew about her. And as I was growing up, you know, she got an opportunity to do residency and rotations in New York and then in Stockton. So over the course of my life, she moved closer and closer to us. So I would see her, but it was one of those things where growing up with an Indian father who's super strict, and then my mom, who was just sort of the antithesis to him, that made it really bittersweet because I really wanted to be around my mom. It's tough being just a kid growing up with an immigrant father and not having that buffer to be there as much, you know? It was really hard. It was hard. Yeah.
So when your mother returned for good to your home and the family was reunited, the family suddenly got much larger because your mother brought with her a 5-year-old girl who you were told was your sister, the sister you'd never met because your mother and father conceived your sister in India during one of his visits to visit your mother. So you were kind of stunned when you found out that you had this sister that nobody ever told you about. Why didn't they tell you?
I think it's one of those things where, okay, this is an important piece of information, but obviously, you know, it's finessed for the one-man show format. My younger sister, Aisha, was born in the States, and then at 2 months after her birth, she went to go live with my grandparents and be raised there. So I didn't officially, you know, get a chance to really meet her until I was 8, you know? And so that, I think, you know, the tough thing was, again, a lot of immigrant households, when you come to the States, you don't have the sort of bandwidth and setup to accommodate a lot of things. You know, my dad is working full time. I'm at school, and then I'm going to sort of an after school daycare program. And now we have a newborn, my little sister. My mom is doing residency and rotations, so she's at a hospital all day. There just wasn't that infrastructure to care for this newborn baby, and also financially, potentially, you know, that wasn't there. My grandparents were in India, and it was set up in such a way that way she could be raised, and she was around cousins, and it was an amazing way for her to grow up. Our narratives are very different. She grew up in India, like, literally, it took a village. She was around people that loved her and were there for her, and I was this brown kid who was alone in America with his dad. And so when she came back, I was just like, I hate this person. Like, who are you? I just wanted a mom. Now I got you.
So I'm going to stop you here because we have a clip from your show Homecoming King in which you talk about how you felt about your sister as this kind of like intruder in your life when she came to live with you. So let's hear that clip. And this is Hasan Minhaj from his new Netflix comedy special Homecoming King.
I hated that brown girl so much. Can I be honest with you guys? I totally understood the wall. I was like, build that wall. I was like a little Republican. I get it. I remember leveling with my parents at the dinner table. I was like, look, mom, dad, let's just be real. Oh my God, these brown people, oh geez. Coming into our house, eating our fruit roll-ups. They don't speak the language. I say we tell them to go back to where they came from. That's just me. He's like, Hasan, you can't say that. We're family. We're all that we have. I'm like, nah, that's on you and mom. Like, you guys decided to get your Angelina Jolie on and bring over this fob in a frock. That's on you. That's not on me.
Okay, that's Hasan Minhaj from his new one-man show, Homecoming King, which will be up on Netflix May 23rd. So you describe in your show that you took all the anger channeled at you, because you're brown and Muslim, and you channeled it at your new sister. How did you realize that you were doing that?
I didn't realize how messed up it was until there was this incident where, you know, I wanted to be treated special in a certain way. And then when my sister got there, my dad took a lot of that guilt and not being able to be there the first several years of her life, missing her first steps, her first words, all of those things. And he got her this gift that I always wanted, this blue BMX bike that I had wanted. It was in the Toys R Us Kids catalog, and I had this cutout on my wall. And then for her fifth birthday, he brings everybody in the living room, and he gives her this bike. And I stole that bike from her, and I took it around the block, even though she lent it to me. She's like, you can take it out for the first ride. And I took it, and I popped a wheelie, and I actually fell off the bike, and I messed up the bike. It, like, fell over, and all the blue paint got, like, chipped off the side of the bike, and I remember her running over and just crying, bawling. And I remember looking down at her and being like, wow, like, this is really messed up. I resent this girl. I hate her. She's like my foil. But I've been looking for acceptance from everyone at school, and she's just wanted to hang out with. That's all she wants. She just wants to be around me. She wants me to teach her about America and teach her English, and she just wants to be my best friend. What am I doing? And it was sort of this moment where I remember finally kind of realizing, it was the first time where I realized maybe family and looking out for one another is an important thing. Like, it's right here underneath my nose, and I should value it.
You talk about immigrants liking secrets, and certainly your father, you put your father in that category. So when you decided to become a comic and talk about yourself, did you have to fight your own instincts? Because I'm sure he instilled in you an instinct to be secretive, but you were defying that instinct.
Yeah. When I first started doing stand-up, I kept it kind of generic. Oh, these are some tropes. This is what it's like, you know, growing up in my life. And I was afraid for the longest time. And I was afraid of this theme that, you know, we talk about a lot in immigrant households. Lo que hacen, what will people think? I just was afraid if I get too real, if I get too honest on stage, people aren't going to like it. The first several years of me doing comedy, it was me hiding comedy from my parents and then me also hiding who I really, really am to the audience. It was almost like I was on the playground all over again. And it wasn't until I started exploring the personal stuff, the one-man show stuff, that I kind of got a chance to be more open to the audience and to my family.
Let's change directions a little bit here.
Yeah.
On The Daily Show, you did a piece at the Republican National Convention about the proposed Muslim ban and the proposed deportation of Muslims, things Donald Trump was talking about. So you interviewed people at the convention. Were these delegates that you were talking to?
Yeah, these were delegates.
Okay. So this was a field piece for The Daily Show, and I want to play some of the conversations you were having with delegates. So here's Hasan Minhaj.
What's the best thing about Oklahoma?
The Oklahoma Sooners.
Well, we call it Maui no Ka'oi, which means Maui is the best.
Wow, I would love to go there sometime.
You're always welcome to come.
I would love to come down and see a game.
Yes, come.
I can't.
Why?
I'm a Muslim, and if Donald Trump is elected, he's probably going to throw me out.
Oh, I don't think so.
Well, he has already asked for a complete and total shutdown of Muslims entering the country, and he's asked for American Muslims to sign up for a registry.
Well, you kind of have to understand a little bit of where he's coming from.
Where he's coming from? Maybe someplace like this?
You told CNN, quote, Islam hates us. Did you mean all 1.6 billion Muslims?
I mean a lot of them. I mean a lot of them.
But for some reason, Republicans don't seem too worried.
He's a guy that shoots off the hip and says things politically incorrect, kind of wild guy.
Sometimes the racist stuff just comes right off the hip.
It comes off the hip, yeah.
What can you do? Bang, bang.
Bang, bang.
Donald Trump isn't going to kick the Muslims out of the United States.
Well, you think he's going to be nicer to Muslims?
I don't know what Donald Trump's going to do. You never know what Donald Trump's going to do, right?
That's what I'm scared about.
Okay, that's Hasan Minhaj doing a piece at the Republican National Convention for The Daily Show. After the election, you did a piece on The Daily Show.
Yeah.
And it ended with you talking about how your mother, at that moment, was in India visiting family. And she called you and said to you, do you think it's safe for me to come home? You know, do you think I'll be able to come home back to America? And you said, I don't know. It sounds like it was a horrible, frightening moment for you. What was the outcome of that?
We got her home ASAP because I didn't know. We were doing a live show that night. It was our election night special. We had a script written that was, you know, it followed what we thought was going to happen, that Hillary Clinton would be president. As the results were coming in, we're literally tearing apart our script. We're rewriting a one-hour live show in real time. And I'm on WhatsApp audio with my mom. My mom being like, we're watching the news. I'm with your grandma. What's going on? And so I'm trying to write jokes about Trump winning the election while I'm on kayak.com looking up tickets for her to come back. I'm also looking up, like, what's the legal recourse? All of a sudden, I have to become an immigration attorney, a son, and a comedian all in one. It was a horrible 48 hours. It was the worst. And not knowing that everything will be okay was just really awful. It was really, really awful.
But you managed to get her home.
We did. We managed to get her home before the Muslim ban happened, too. I didn't want to risk anything. Like, we got her home. She was supposed to be there for several months, and we just got her home ASAP.
Hasan Minhaj, it's been really great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Terry. I appreciate it.
Hasan Minhaj is a correspondent for The Daily Show. His comedy special, Homecoming King, will be available on Netflix starting Tuesday. Music critic Milo Miles has a review of a new collection of synthesizer dance music from the Cape Verde Islands, recorded in the 70s and 80s. He says the music sweeps you up with energy and rhythm and reveals an international modernism not well known outside Cape Verde.
Popular music anthologies that collect a span of various performers can deliver a special revelation. They can uncover a whole world of music through an inspired selection of tracks expertly programmed. The retrospective collection Synthesize the Soul is subtitled Astro-Atlantic Hypnotica from the Cape Verde Islands, 1973 to 1988, which sounds to me like a direct echo of the landmark Garage Rock Nuggets anthology from 1972. Synthesize the Soul will not make pop history like Nuggets, but it's as much a surprise and a perfectly paced, seductive dance party. Daqui a pouco
porque que lá é bom problema. Goza boa vida, mas quem vou ver? Também que lá é bom problema. Passa sabe, mas quem vou ver? Vamos de bom problema. Oi, 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 oi.
Among those who know any performer from Cape Verde, the late singer Cesária Évora dominates massively. One might easily think her languorous, often melancholy form called Morna was the only soundtrack to Cape Verde. But like Cuba's Buena Vista Social Club, Évora sounded like a carefully packaged artifact of pre-electric popular song. The fundamental surprise of Synthesize the Soul is that long before the international audience discovered Évora, the young hotshots on the islands and Verde immigrants in Europe were cranking up the amps and enjoying hits. The music on Synthesize the Soul did not have an agreed-on name, but I would vote for Fuana Fusion. The style called Fuana flourished in the African-oriented island of Santiago, where it was played on accordions and much frowned upon by Portuguese colonial authorities. This would not be the only instance in which peppy roots music adapted remarkably well to synthesizers and electric guitars. A host of Cape Verde expats working in Lisbon, Paris, and Providence, Rhode Island, among other locations, all contributed to the course of this eclectic style. No accident, though, that the player on the cover of the set is multi-instrumentalist and arranger Paulinho Vieira, an enigmatic figure who was involved in more than half the tracks on Synthesize the Soul, such as this one, Bota Cool. Final surprise from this collection, it turns out that Vieira was bandleader for Cesária Évora during her breakout period in the 90s and the architect of her first international score, Saudade. So Cape Verdean music, no matter the style or the location of the players, suggests tight island relationships. A salute to Synthesize the Soul compiler Vic Sohoni for properly presenting adventurous unknowns and making them sound almost essential.
Milo Miles reviewed the new collection of music from the Cape Verde Islands called Synthesize the Soul. There's a new comedy series co-created by my guest Jill Soloway. She's best known for her Amazon comedy series Transparent, about a family of three adult children and their two parents. At the beginning of the first season, the father, who's in his mid-70s, comes out as trans and soon starts transitioning to female. Like Transparent, Soloway's new series has storylines about gender identity and sexuality. It's from the point of view of a married, feminist, independent filmmaker who can't quite explain her attraction to a macho, swaggering, self-absorbed artist named Dick, who's dismissive of her and of her work. She begins to write letters to the artist to try to express and analyze her feelings.
Dear Dick, every letter is a love letter.
She doesn't initially send the letters, but they become her art piece. The filmmaker, Chris, is played by Catherine Hahn. The artist, Dick, is played by Kevin Bacon. The series is called I Love Dick. It's set at a small art institute founded by Dick in Marfa, Texas. Chris is there with her husband, Silver, a cultural critic who's at the institute on a fellowship. The series was inspired by a book of the same name, written by filmmaker and writer Chris Krauss. The title of the series isn't the only double entendre. Here's the first meeting between Chris and Dick.
Hi, I'm Chris Krauss.
Well, hello, Chris Krauss.
Dick, right?
That's me.
I've heard a lot about you, Dick. Love that you just go by Dick, because usually someone would, you know, if one is born a Richard, they would Rich, Rick, Richie, Ricky. So many.
Just Dick.
Is it possible that I saw you on a horse yesterday?
Yeah, I have a ranch just outside of town.
Oh. How big? I'm curious.
You want to know how big my ranch is? No more polite to ask a rancher the size of his acreage than to ask a lady her age.
Duly noted. I'm just, for the record, I'm on the dividing line. I'm straddling 40-ish.
Okay, that's a clip from the first episode of I Love Dick. Jill Soloway, welcome to Fresh Air. So the Kevin Bacon character, Dick, is just the kind of man who the Chris character theoretically would reject because he's self-centered, he's macho, he condescends to her, he's dismissive of women artists. And so, especially in the beginning, he has this like super macho walk and super macho gaze. So why did you cast Kevin Bacon? And I'm wondering if you came of age with any of his movies, any of his early films.
Strangely, I didn't. So I think I never saw Footloose. I watched it after we shot the show, and I was like, "Oh, those hips, that walk—it's all the same. It's all from Footloose." But for whatever reason, I think I just missed that. I think I'm a little older, but I think a big thing for me in casting him, besides the fact that it was this very receptive thing, which is like, I sort of do this on Transparent too. I don't overthink it. It's very much like, who is this person? And then the person comes into my consciousness, and it's kind of done. And the second that Kevin came into my consciousness, besides the fact that he's an amazing actor and a sex symbol, I really felt like the way that Kevin Bacon is a symbol for something, the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, really relates to who Dick is.
In what sense?
Well, Dick is this word, like bacon is a word. Bacon means something other than a person, as does Dick. And we stole a little bit from the life of Donald Judd. We took the character of Dick in the book, and then we took Donald Judd, who's kind of the patriarch of Marfa, an amazing artist.
A famous artist, yeah.
A famous artist who really built the town, whose ideas about art and the land are almost a mythology for this town. And the way that Donald Judd has this kind of fame in Marfa is sort of similar to the way that Kevin Bacon has this following, the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon and what he means to people. And that's what we wanted Dick to be.
So the series is set in the art world and the world of cultural theory. So it's the world of like semiotics, aesthetics, aesthetic theory, and all the language that goes along with that. And you treat it, I think, in a very comic way. So here's another scene from the first episode. Chris and her husband, Silver, have invited Dick, the head of this art institute, out to dinner to try to make a good impression on him. They're talking about Silver's work writing on aesthetics and the Holocaust, and then the conversation shifts to Chris's work and the film that she submitted to the Venice Film Festival, the independent film. They're eating at a restaurant called The Rope and Loin, and Silver, Chris's husband, speaks first.
It's when you try to assign an aesthetic to the Holocaust. I mean, does trauma even need an aesthetic?
Why would trauma need an aesthetic?
Exactly. That's what I'm here. I'm here trying to find it, you know? And for that, I'm gonna need total immersion. What I'm preoccupied with is how the materiality of death transfers to the living, like an airborne contamination, if you will.
That's why I slept with a mortician.
You slept with a mortician?
She's kidding.
He likes a cold bed.
Excuse me?
Easy on the red, babe. Mm-hmm.
So what do you do when he's not a mortician?
I recently made a film that was invited to screen at Venice. But I guess for very complicated reasons, that's not going to happen.
Why? What kind of complication?
Just some. Encountered some very greedy musicians.
You didn't pay for the music?
Well, they were asking for an outrageous amount.
Yes.
Who would do that to indie filmmakers? I mean, it's just so grotesquely unfair.
Well, it's unfair. It's unfair that you don't get to use somebody else's work for free. I mean, astonishingly beautiful piece of music can make an astonishingly beautiful scene. An astonishingly beautiful scene can separate a mediocre film from a masterpiece. And I'm assuming that's what you're going for. The masterpiece, big prize. What's it about? Your film.
It's about a couple. Mm. Or I would say the woman in the couple, actually. I guess she kind of represents all women and society's, crushing expectations.
Sounds horrible. Sounds like you're crushed by something.
So that's a scene from I Love Dick, and my guest Jill Soloway is the creator of the series. So let me start with the beginning of that conversation. Do issues like does trauma need an aesthetic and language about the materiality of death transferring to the living, does that kind of like cultural aesthetic, semiotic kind of language mean anything to you?
No, I mean, when he says, does trauma need an aesthetic? And Silvera says, exactly. I mean, that's funny to me because I don't even know what that means. Does trauma need an aesthetic? I mean, I laugh at that joke because it's 100% nonsense to me. I'm not an academic at all. So we're just kind of, splashing around in these words.
When you were growing up, who were some of the characters in movies and TV or in books that represented a kind of femininity that you didn't identify with, like main characters who you felt like, gee, I'm not like that. And I don't think I could be like that.
Yeah, I mean, I felt a feeling growing up, a constant feeling of, I can't believe this is supposed to be me upon watching all of the television that I love. So I was really into beauty pageants, but they're totally humiliating. I loved watching them, but I think for the reason of like, oh my God, this is what grown-up women become, our beauty pageant contestants. And then I think watching Love Boat and Fantasy Island and the kind of stuff that I was raised on really just frightened me about the expectations of women. I mean, I think I also watched Mary Tyler Moore and Phyllis and Rhoda and watched those great shows with my mom. So I had an example of women who weren't all about how well they fulfilled a man's imagination, but those shows just did not exist. In fact, all the way up through watching Sex and the City, I would feel incredibly upset by what I thought was an expectation of me, which was you should really love cute shoes. And you should, because you're a woman, you're going to go crazy for a particular dress. And these are some of my own evolutions. I remember when we spoke a couple years ago about Transparent, we were talking about clothes. And I think since we last spoke, I've become more queer and more gender nonconforming and basically gotten rid of everything that one would consider femme presenting in my life. And that's been a very a matching process with the process of discovering the female gaze and sort of letting go of some of these patriarchal ideas of what women should be.
Actually, we have a clip that we've prepared from your earlier Fresh Air interview, which speaks exactly to what you're saying here.
Amazing.
Yeah. So this is from October 30th, 2014, when we were talking about Transparent. And we were talking about just being so uncomfortable with clothing choices and what a woman is expected to look like. So let's go back to 2014. This is my interview with Jill Soloway from then.
Today, I would say I'm dressed sort of like a boy. And on other days, I look pretty feminine and will put on makeup and get my hair done and look pretty ladylike. And I think I've always had that struggle my whole life of feeling a little bit more gender neutral, feeling more comfortable as a creative person when I'm dressed like a boy, when
kind of dress more masculine. So if I'm doing comedy, if I'm writing, if I'm working, I like to wear jeans and a t-shirt and no makeup and feel kind of masculine because it makes me really focus on what I'm doing. It puts the work first, which is odd to even say that. It even realize that little codes and cues like I don't need to be looked at, I don't need to be appreciated, I don't need to be pretty, allow me to be more creative. I mean, just that sentence is totally fascinating. I'm only realizing it right now. But then when I have to be photographed or I have to be seen or I have to be, you know, Jill Soloway, the showrunner, go on stage, get my picture taken, I really, really, really don't like the way I look. I mean, I have to get my hair and my makeup done or I look, when I'm photographed, like somebody I don't want to look like, which is this really weird struggle. So I, you know, as a woman, as a feminist, I constantly struggle with how femme do I want to look? How pretty do I need to be? And I remember, a few years ago, before my parent came out, actually, like crying before an HBO Emmy party because I was wearing clothes that I hated, but I felt like I had to wear to dress up. So whatever it is, Spanx, pantyhose, bra, you know, like all that stuff that means lady dressed up. If I'm not in the right mood, it can make me just start sobbing. I know a lot of women who feel that way, like that they feel like they're putting on drag when they're getting quote unquote dressed up.
Okay, so that's Jill Soloway recorded in October of 2014 during, I think it was the first season of Transparent. And now she has a new Amazon series called I Love Dick. So Jill, do you still put on those clothes that you really don't like because you think you have to when you appear before the camera at awards ceremonies or other occasions like that? Or have you given up even trying to dress like the kind of woman that you don't feel comfortable dressing like?
Yeah, I mean, it's so amazing to hear that because now I'm able to listen to that and recognize that, you know, what I was talking about was gender dysphoria or gender fugue or something that's very common for people who identify as non-binary. I don't have that problem anymore because I don't dress that way anymore. So I've evolved a lot, I think, since we spoke last. And yeah, I basically only wear men's clothes now. And I wear minimal makeup and my hair is really short. I think it took a few years after my parent came out to really say to myself, hey, you might also have gender stuff going on. And yeah, I'm so much more comfortable now in my public presentation of myself. I never dress femme at all. I can't remember if I was out. I don't even know if I had come out. I identify as queer now and non-binary. And so I'm probably a different person in relationship to how I look.
You certainly didn't identify. You didn't identify as queer in our interview. I don't know what was going on in your personal life, but that didn't come out in the interview, and you didn't identify as non-binary. When you refer to your father coming out, you're referring to your father coming out as trans. And her being trans was the inspiration for your series Transparent, which is about a parent who comes out as trans late in life, as your parent did. So in what ways did that kind of open the door for you to kind of challenge some of your assumptions about yourself and also challenge you to change in ways that you wanted to change?
Yeah, it's funny. You kind of get confronted with these questions. You know, a lot of it is, I think, success, where you go, okay, I have success. I have a TV show. I won an award. You know, I have everything I thought I wanted. Why am I still not happy? And then you start to look into these little things, you know? And for me, it was, I hate it when somebody comes over to do my makeup. And I hate dressing up. Why am I doing it? I'm going to stop doing it. And for me, having met so many non-binary people, met so many genderqueer people, and realizing that another way you can move through the world is to be neither male nor female has been so inspiring. And a lot of women do relate to it. You know, for example, like once I start to see myself as non-binary, if a hostess at a restaurant says, "Right this way, ladies," I start to get really angry because I'm like, I'm dressed like a man. What is making him say lady? Like, where is the lady that he sees when he's bringing me to this table? And a lot of women get mad, actually, whether or not they identify as non-binary. A lot of people get mad when they say ladies or girls or these things that group women into this category.
Do you say anything to the person who's saying "Right This Way, Ladies"? Or do you just get angry to yourself?
I was thinking about writing up a card. I mean, I think the problem I came to is I realized, like, these are people trying to do their job. And I don't want to have—to me, it almost became this class problem where I don't want to be really lecturing somebody who is doing a job where I'm sort of telling them, you know, they're doing their job wrong. I haven't quite figured out how to do it. Should we practice? Do you want to say "Right This Way, Ladies"?
And sure. Okay. "Right This Way, Ladies."
Excuse me. I'm sorry. I don't want to bother you, but I don't identify as female. So if you could say "folks" or "friends."
I don't understand what you're talking about when you say you don't identify as female. I mean, you're a woman, right? You're a woman wearing man clothes. So I'm role playing here.
Yes, I appreciate that.
I don't even know what you're talking about, lady.
Thank you, fine host. There are some people who identify as female, and there are some people who identify as male, and there are some people who identify as neither or both. It's called non-binary. I am one of those people. And so when you use the word "lady" to refer to me, it feels like you're speaking to somebody else.
Okay.
And then that's the guy's like, the spits in my
over.
Food. He goes into the kitchen and says, "Spit in their food."
Jill Soloway, thank you so much for coming back to Fresh
Air. Thank you so much, Terry Gross. Can I come a third time in a couple years?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I'll be like, remember when I was identifying as genderqueer?
We'll play back tape from then.
Okay, good.
Jill Soloway is the co-creator of the new series, I Love Dick. The entire first season is available on Amazon. Season 4 of Soloway's series, Transparent, is currently wrapping and will be on Amazon later this year. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.